Hi, this is Ken McCarthy of Jazz on the Tube, and we're working on our hopefully endless series. We're just going to keep working on this for as many years as we can, remembering Ornette. And the theory here is Ornette Coleman was obviously one of the great musicians of the ages, instrumentalist, band leader, composer, but he was also a fascinating human being, and you really can't fully appreciate that unless you ever met him. So what we're trying to do with these calls is talk with people that worked with Ornette and have them share their experience of him. I've shared mine, and we've had other people share theirs, and today we've got Dave Bryant. Hey, Dave, welcome.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me.
So, Dave, could you let people know about your background, anybody that might not already know you? You know, what you're up to, you know, what you play, what instrument you play, how you started in music, where you're at now?
I played keyboards with Ornette starting in 1990, in that second edition of Prime Time, and I'm on the Tone Dialing album. And before that, I used to informally study with him and go audit his rehearsals as the first Prime Time for most of the 80s. And
wow.
I grew up in Virginia, and I spent my first couple of college years at Shenandoah Conservatory there, and I came up to Berkeley in 1978. And let's jump ahead to my roommate at one point was a guy that worked in the ensemble office, and he came in and said, there's a new teacher that says he played piano with Ornette. And so I knew at the time that that was an imaginary gig. That was like, say, you know, there's a new teacher who says he's been to the moon. You know, that just didn't happen. So I was like, who is this guy? I got to hook up. And so it turned out to be Bruce Thomas, who worked for some capacity with Horizon and Artist House Records with John Snyder. And you know how those albums always had like a transcription in the gatefold. Bruce was the guy that did those transcriptions. And his brother, I think, also worked with him. And so they were all in this band, the White House Band, together, which the way he put it was Ornette's experiment to see if he could communicate his theoretical ideas to white people. So,
gosh, I remember him talking about that because he had Prime Time, and he had mentioned this idea of having the White House Band, and I thought it was just a fancy, you know, some concept he had, but he actually had such a band.
Right, right, and so it's obviously a play also on Artist House, and also, I guess, in line with his fascination with the building itself, as in the Men Who Live in the White House movement of Skies of America, so.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of precedent for that. But anyway, I finally hooked up with Bruce and signed up with him as my piano teacher and came in and just told him I wanted to talk about Ornette, and he was great. He brought in books of manuscript paper that Ornette had written out things for him. He brought in cassettes of rehearsals and played them for me, answered all my questions or as many as I could bombard him with. And just a really good experience. And so at some point, I think this was would have been December of 81, there was an interview with Ornette in Downbeat, and he mentioned something about having a student. And I asked Bruce, I said, Ornette has students? And he kind of shrugged, and I said, could I, like, study with him? And Bruce said, I guess. He says, you know, you could always ask. And I said, how much do you think he'd charge? And Bruce said, well, put it this way. If he takes you on, it won't be about the bread. And I thought, oh, okay. So, you know, we'll see how this works. So a friend of mine was a sound guy at the Performance Center. And so whenever that was, December of 81, they came to play at the Performance Center, and I snuck into the sound check. And when they went backstage, I jumped up and followed him back, and by the time I had gotten up there and back there, it was deserted. Nobody was there. And so I'm nervous, you know, I'm sneaking around, and I went and got some water out of the water fountain. And when I stood up with my cheeks full of water, Ornette runs by and goes, "Hi, how you doing?" and just keeps going. And so I had to swallow the water, and finally I called him back. He was halfway up the stairs. I went through my life story. "I'm Mr. Coleman. I want to study with him, Bruce Thomas." It was, you know, everything. And so he says, "Yeah, okay." He said, "Well, I don't see why we can't get together." He said, "I'll be in the book in a couple of months." So he says, "Give me a call." And when I tell students this story now, they give me a blank look and say, "What does this expression, 'I'll be in the book,' mean?"
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, they don't know what a phone book is.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? And so I remember...
He always stayed in the phone book, because I'll actually put it this way. When I knew him and was hanging around with him quite a bit for a while, people would just call him out of the blue because he was in the phone book.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I mean, right up till the end, I mean, he got calls constantly. I mean, one of the last times that I've, you know, spent a weekend at his place, the phone just rang off the hook. And I always thought when I called, you know, I was the only one, or at least not part of the cast of thousands I evidently was. And he would go all day and all night. I mean, he would take these one-hour-plus calls, hang up, have a drink of water, and the phone would ring again. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, when he would hang up, sometimes I'd hear him and I'd think, "Oh, he's talking to some young kid, and he's encouraging him and telling him to hang in there, don't give up, and advice about the music business and all this." And he'd hang up, and he'd say, "That was," and he would tell me who it was, and it would be like somebody that I knew as having a career. You know, it would be like a well-known person. So it was it wasn't just aspiring young students that would call him. It was, you know, pros.
Yeah,
everybody wanted some counsel.
Yeah. It was quite a scene. I remember one night Don Cherry and David Byrne came by. You know, just dropped by. You know, just saying hi. Wow. So this happened when you were a student at Berkeley.
That's right. Yeah. And so, where was I with that? With Bruce. Oh, and so with Ornette, I called up New York Information and I said, "Do you have the number for Ornette Coleman?" And I remember the operator saying, "Is that a business?" I always like that question. But anyway, so yeah, we got together. That was at the time that he was being represented by the Bernsteins, right? Sid Bernstein. And so I think he wanted one of those Beatles Shea Stadium gig or something like that.
Yeah, I remember that. That was like late 70s.
So I'm thinking, I remember he said, in the meantime, I could write him a letter. And I wrote him a letter that he never got. But after talking to him on the phone, I sent him a cassette of my senior recital at Berkeley. And one of the tunes I did was Dee Dee off the Golden Circle album. And, you know, some other things. And so... finally, I guess this would have been, I think it was like the autumn of 83, I want to say. I gave him a call and asked if it would be okay if I came to New York and had a lesson in person, you know, a real sit-down, face-to-face, on-paper lesson. And he said, "Oh, sure, I don't see why we couldn't do that." And so we were talking earlier about the place he lived on Rivington Street. And so my friend, drummer Chris Bowman, whom you know, and I made the trek over there and found the place and went up and had a pleasant afternoon.
Wow, and that was, what year would that have been, do you think?
83,
okay. Right. And it was just a social visit.
Well, it was an informal lesson, I guess is the way I would put it. And, you know, at one point the doorbell rang, and... when he went to answer the door, alluding to the visitors as you were, Chris turned to me and he said, "You realize that could be anybody." And so it turned out to be Kathleen Hoffman, or Kathleen Gray, namesake of the composition that I played the solo introduction on every night when I played with him. So that was interesting.
Wow. I don't know who Kathleen Gray is.
Well, that she deserves a better introduction than I have knowledge of to give her, but she was with that Theater of All Possibilities and the Biosphere Project and that whole group of people.
Oh, okay.
Johnny Dolphin and that whole team.
Okay.
So you made that first visit with Chris, and Chris, of course, is drummer, friend. I'm drawing a blank on his last name.
Chris Bowman. Yes, yes.
And
so we had a trio together called Shock Exchange with the bassist John Turner that I knew from Berkeley. And the three of us still, it's very rare that the three of us are in the same room together, but I still play with John and Chris in different contexts all these years later. And so, but both of them used to go over with me to Ornette's a lot, and so, you know, Ornette knew them well, and I was, you know, actually, I think the last time we were all in the same room was at Ornette's Memorial, so.
Okay. What was that first lesson like?
Well, when we finally got down to, if you remember the room there in Rivington with the big space heaters and the high ceilings and the big windows and stuff, and we finally sat down around a table, and he took out some manuscript paper, his ever-present manuscript paper, and he said, okay, he said, now, we're going to write a song together. And he looked at me, and of course, I was just flustered at how old would I have been, to, you know, 25, something like that. And write a song with Ornette Coleman, what is this going to be about? So anyway, he said, all right, so let's say our first note is a G. And he starts writing a G on the manuscript paper on the staff. And he looks over at me and he says, is that all right with you? And I said, oh, yeah, that's fine. And he says, okay. And I says, all right, now let's say the second note. So what do you think that second note should be? And so I had already heard him make the point to me that the most useful interval in music was the third, and preferably the major third, but that just in general, the third was the most useful interval in music. So I'm thinking the right answer is probably going to be a third. So I said, I'd say B. And he'd go, and he started to write, and he said, a B. And I said, yeah, you sure? And I said, yep. And he says, okay, B natural or B flat? And I said, so now I'm getting tricky. And I said, well, I guess either one would work. And he looked at me with this, you know, kind of don't BS me, buddy. And he said, I know either one would work. He said, what I asked you was, which one would be better? And I, all of a sudden, I just had this, you know, epiphany that's what made him Ornette, was that for anybody else, well, either one would work, but it was important which one was better to be able to make that determination. And I thought, wow, that's how you separate the men from the boys, to use a hopelessly outmoded expression.
Wow. I mean, but you have to admit that's an unusual way to compose.
Yeah, it was interesting. He said, he also told me, I remember, that the most important note of the composition was the third note. Because, you know, the first note could be anything. And you establish some sort of relationship intervallically with the second note. So, you know, that was important. But you really had to commit yourself with the third note.
Wow.
Because that really brought it full circle and contextualized the first two. And so, again, another example of a rule of thirds there in harmonics.
No one has ever, in all the talking I've done with people about Ornette, no one's ever mentioned this, and this is really fascinating. I'm thinking of Lonely Woman. I'm thinking of Catherine Gray. Is that the name of the tune?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of that third note. And yeah, it actually did do something important. Wow, so, all right, so started with the G, You went to a third.
Are you taking this down?
It
didn't get much farther than that third note, so there's no lost masterwork there.
Okay. All right. Now, what were you thinking? I mean, clearly you've never been to a composition class where that had been like this.
Well, one of the reasons or things that was in my head, I guess, that had inspired me to do this in the first place was at the time, I don't know, was it like the NEA or somebody was giving grants out to people to study with, well, the people in my circle of friends that I knew were like somebody was trying to hook up something to study with Cecil Taylor. And it was the deal, you try to get him to sign the paper, and if he'll sign the paper, then you can present the grant proposal to the NEA, and then they'll give Cecil the money, and then, you know, hopefully lessons would follow or some sort of interaction with Cecil would follow. And there was somebody else I knew that I think was approaching Elvin Jones, something like that. And then I was at Berkeley at the same time that Steve Vai was there.
Okay.
And I remember Steve Vai running out of his dorm room screaming, "Frank called back! Frank called back!" I mean, he had sent in transcriptions to Frank Zappa, and Frank Zappa called him back. And so I thought, well, you know, I was a young man in my early 20s, and I thought, well, I guess this is how it works. You know, this is, why not? If there's somebody out there that you think that, you know, would be interesting to study with, try to hook it up. And as Bruce said, the worst that can happen is they can say no. And I always thought that Ornette would be like the biggest stretch for a piano player.
Okay.
And I was at the time listening to a lot of pianoless music, you know, like the Art Ensemble or the local group here in Boston, The Fringe, that you may have heard of, that's based here in Boston. And I'm cracking that nut of how to play piano and not ruin a pianoless format was something that I thought about a lot and still think about a lot.
And Ornette really didn't work with piano players. I think his first album had a piano player on it, and then that was it for a long time.
Yeah, one of those first conversations, I asked him why he didn't like the piano. And he said, I like the piano. He said, I don't like piano players. And again, I had this moment of, I know exactly what he means.
Wow.
And because there's, you know, there's a way piano players think. There's a way they phrase. There's a way they modulate. There's a way that equal temperament does strange things to a person. You know, it's just, there's a whole way of sequential thinking that's setups and payoffs, you know, harmonically that are just anathema to the way Ornette thought about music.
Okay. Makes sense. So how did you become the guy that played piano with Ornette Coleman, given that he didn't like piano players?
Well,
are we jumping too far ahead?
At some point, he actually called me one time and said, my band is going to be rehearsing the next couple of weeks. Would you like to come to New York and hear us rehearse? And I said, wow, that would be great. So I went down, and I mean, I've stayed there for these at the time. I mean, that was probably the time that you may have seen some of these too, these marathon rehearsals that went on 10, 12, 14 hours. I mean, just, you know, all day into the night.
Yep.
And I was just captivated, and a lot of times I would be the only outside person there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I would think, where is the rest of the world? You know, what's going on musically that's any more interesting than this, you know?
I had the same experience. But this was at the loft on Bowery, and I talked with you earlier, and I have a recording also in this series, how I met Ornette through finding him a building. And you know, basically, he said, come around noon. And when I came around noon, he had a cheesecake for the band, because they had already been playing all morning. and they had the cheesecake and some lunch, and then they played all afternoon and all night, and finally I had to get going, he just set a folding chair down in the middle of the loft and said, okay. So I'm sitting there getting a private multi-hour show from primetime, and I guess you had that same experience.
Yeah. And so what was really great was I got to, it was sort of the third prong of my education from them, because I had, again, these lessons, phone calls, and again, very informal. I'd talk to him on the phone. I would send him tapes of my playing, and I would write compositions and bring them in or play them to him over the phone. I didn't know when this was going to run out, you know, and I always thought, I've got to earn my keep, and each time I talk to him, each time I interact with him, I need to present him proof that time he spent with me last time has had beneficial impact on my music.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So he doesn't feel like he's wasting his time.
Right.
And I kept that going as long as I knew him, actually. But so I had that relationship going. Then I had, as I said, this trio with John and Chris, and three of us would play, and so a lot of times I'd be getting back from one of those rehearsals or one of the lessons I'd had with him, and they'd be like, well, what did he say? And you know how you probably had this experience with him where his use of the English language was so idiosyncratic that while you were talking with him, it seemed perfectly clear what he was trying to communicate, but then right afterwards, if somebody asked you, what did he say, you would be at a loss to try to explain it to them or to articulate it yourself. He got his meaning across, but you didn't, the exact words, you know, didn't come back, and so it was hard to, again, go through the process the day after to articulate it in whatever your idea of traditional English was. So
yep.
I got in the habit of knowing they were going to ask me when he would be talking to me and making a point. When I understood it, I would in my head convert it to what I thought was, you know, seemed like straightforward English. And a lot of times I would stop him and I'd say, so what you're saying is such and such, would that be correct, you know, something like that, and I would try to get him to confirm, you know, whatever it was that I my transliteration there.
Did you have luck with that approach?
Yeah.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, and I held him to it, you know. I mean, I occasionally he would, you know, before he knew me very well, he'd get a little defensive, you know, because it's sort of like I would, you know, I didn't want it to be like I was trying to put words in his mouth, but I think he would, you know, again, be a little uncomfortable with that. But I think he just saw it. I was so persistent, and I guess it had to be obvious. I really wanted to be sure of what it was he was trying to tell me, that, you know, eventually he would relent and say, yeah, that's it, just to get rid of me, I think. But so anyway, that was the second prong. And then the third prong was hearing it in action with primetime. And when I first heard them play, I've told this story in other contexts too, but that band would always sort of getting into the tune, getting into the rehearsal, there was always kind of a slow coalescing of the parts coming together. It would be sort of like a car motor starting on a cold morning. It would just kind of ka-funka, 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 and gradually it would build up speed, and, you know, at some point they would just take off. But it would be like I would hear the tunes go by, or the, you know, they would do the same tune over and over and over. And at one point, somebody would say, oh, that's the one right there. And they go, oh, yeah, that was good, that was good. And to me, I couldn't tell the difference. It sounded about the same as what had come before. And I thought, what is it that they're hearing? And so I would sit there and try to figure this thing out. In between, I would go up and I would ask Ornette a question, something I noticed, is this right? I would talk to the guys in the band. I'd say, listen, so when you're playing this and this, you know, I would be able to ask them kind of detailed technical questions, and it would be fresh right there as it was happening, you know, so it was, that was just invaluable to be able to do that. And gradually, just from being there, you know, day after day, eventually there came a point where I'd be listening to the take and I'd think, that's the one. They'd get through with it and somebody else would say, that's the one. And I'd go, that's it, I got it, you know. But it was like, it wasn't something like I walked in off the street and, oh, yes, I know exactly what's going on here. I'm not going to tell you that. I had studied for a while.
And what was it that you heard that made you realize that, oh, that was the one?
I guess the way I would express it would be relationships between the component parts of, you know, the instruments, the different lines and that type of thing, the way phrases were placed. Our friend Bern Nix always used to say that bad harmonics is like spaghetti. You know, too many lines going together and all this. And so I kind of jokingly countered that good harmonics was like plaid. You know, where it's sort of the lines are spaced well and at a right angles, and there's a transparency there, where there's a strength and a transparency at the same time, if you get the visual metaphor there.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, he was fascinated with Buckminster Fuller's tone structure. I mean, he was into that, and I never knew why. And now maybe I'm getting a hint of why.
So much of his thinking, even his use of language, I think owes a big debt to Fuller. And I think part of it is they're just kindred spirits. But there was a guy, a young guy, we were all young guys then, but around the same time, very early 80s, who was an aspiring bass player, and I think he was from Texas, and I want to say that his other work was in as an aspiring journalist. And I can't remember the guy's name, and I remember asking Ornette about him, you know, a couple of years later, and Ornette saying that he had gone back to Texas from New York. But I remember talking to him one time and him talking about coining of the word harmonic was very much like these compound words that Fuller coined, like dimaxion, or popularized like synergy or geodesic or one of those words, you know. And I thought, yeah, that's very much. And again, the triangle is the basic, most useful structure, very much like the interval of the third being the most useful interval.
Yeah. Wow.
And so there's just a lot of that I think, you know, he really felt a deep kinship and resonance with Fuller.
Okay. Wow, this is really, I have to tell you, this is an illuminating call for me. A lot of mysteries are being cleared up, or at least, yeah, they're being, there's a light on them now. So you were there as a student, just invited to watch rehearsal after rehearsal after rehearsal.
That's right. And I have to say, even though as wonderful as the friendship aspect of our relationship became, as far as I'm concerned, my primary relationship to Mr. Coleman is that of student.
I think everybody, he always had something to teach or share, or something that he was amazed by that he wanted to let you know about. I remember towards the end, I visited him, and someone had come by with recording of a Jewish cantor.
Oh, yeah.
And he was just so taken by, I didn't hear the recording, but he was just so taken by that. He really wanted to talk about it. Wow. Wow. So how did it evolve from being a guy sitting watching and listening to somebody playing?
He had told me, and this would have been around the time after the Virgin Beauty record, I was talking to him on the phone, one time, and he said, you know, I'm thinking about finally adding a piano player. And I said, well, you know, if that happens, because I've been around long enough then to know that, you know, whatever it was that you thought might happen would not necessarily happen in that particular circle. And I said, well, you know, if you do decide to do something like that, I hope I would get a chance to audition or something mm-hmm. like that. And he said, well, that's what I'm talking about. And that's all he said right then, and I didn't push it. So anyway, I was at work where I did some part-time work, and I'm not sure how DiNardo got the number. But he called me on the phone at work and said, Dave, he said, I don't know if my father told you about this, but we're going to Italy in a couple of months. And he said, I wonder if Dave would like to go. And so that was it. Now, having said that, that would have been 1990, and in 1988 was when he, you know, had got the new band with Chris and Kenny and Bottle Roy. And I thought, well, that's that. If I, you know, if I was going to be in the band, that would have been my shot when he had a complete turnover. And so I thought, well, yeah, that's probably not going to happen. But yeah, that's all right. I'm still learning a lot. So if I can still come around and hear him rehearse. I never did hear that band rehearse before I was in it, though. But anyway, so that was it. So
was that when you went to Verona?
Well, no. First trip was that I was on was Reggio Emilia.
Oh, okay.
And Parma.
And so, I mean, there was obviously stuff that happened between the time you got the invite and the time you got on the plane. Were you rehearsing in New York?
Yes.
Okay.
It was with Kenny Wessel and Chris Rosenberg, guitarist, and Al McDowell was still playing bass, and Bottle Roy, the tabla player, and DiNardo.
Okay.
And so he asked me to come. I think they had done a tour in 88, and I don't know if they had done nothing at all in 89, or at least not much. And then they were regrouping in 90, and what it was Chris Walker, the bass player that was on Virgin Beauty, along with Al, had been playing with him. And he was doing some other things, I think, playing with Al Giroux or something. But he had left and was on the road with somebody else. And that's when Ornette decided to try this. So he asked me to come in a couple of days before everybody else and just to have some time to work with him on some stuff. And so the very first day he handed me a lead sheet to Kathleen Gray and said, this will be your feature. Mm. And we hadn't, you know, I hadn't played a note yet. That seemed to be just, I have a couple of ideas as to why that may have happened that way, but that was, you know, kind of the way he approached it, was that we were starting from Kathleen Gray. And so I had these keyboards with me, and I didn't know at the time. I didn't have a keyboard with me that I could really play pianistically. You know, I didn't have at the time Fender Rhodes and that kind of thing were out of favor. And I had an organ kind of keyboard, like a Hammond organ type of you know, knockoff, and a polysynth and a mini Moog. And so when we sat down to play it, we worked out, I got like a string pad on the polysynth, and we worked out two-note voicings going through all the chords and phrases of Kathleen Gray. And I played the melody, my right hand on the mini Moog, and then I played these two-note voicings, my left hand, on this string pad.
Hmm.
And so it was an interesting arrangement, actually. And then when the rest of the band came in, I just more or less played the string pad with that. And eventually, because I know I stopped using the very first tour. I did use that organ keyboard, but it became obvious that that wasn't going to work so much with Ornette. For some reason, just I think the intonation of that kind of Hammond organ sound really didn't blend well with the alto and with the free range of intonation that he employed. You know, he did so much with just little microtonal shadings of pitch that you really got a lot of clashes with that kind of Hammond organ sound. That seems to be an alto thing too. I've had that situation with other alto players.
Okay.
But so then after the first tour, I ended up getting like a digital sample piano, 88 key instrument, and played that a lot as sort of my bass keeper.
So how did you get around that microtone thing with your piano? That's a big challenge for, it seems like it would be one.
Yeah, for me, I may not have taken the road less traveled if I'd known it was going to take that long to get going on it. But I thought, well, I don't want to be a sitting duck and be playing an equal-tempered version of the key we're supposedly in. And so I tried to figure out other relationships of other keys to the key we were in. You know, sort of the way you might think of higher part, I don't know how technical you want to get here, but the way, you know, people would pile up tensions on a dominant seven chord and say, you know, one thing with Ornette was he never, theoretically, would never talk about scale degrees higher than a seven.
Hmm.
It would always be like, you know, if you had like a C tonality and then had D, F sharp, A, he wouldn't talk about that like 9, sharp, 11, 13. That was always like polytonal, C and D, a C triad and a D triad.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is because he was always looking for the best trade-off between, he wanted the freedom, but he also wanted strength. So a triad is going to be stronger than extended tensions. You know, that's getting out, if the root note is at the trunk of the tree, by the time you get to those extended tensions on a dominant seven, you're out at a thin part of the branch. You know, it's like he wanted to keep it as close as he could. So that, again, that Fullerian, if we can call it Buckminster Fuller inspired, or not inspired, what should we say, reinforced, vindicated
mm-hmm.
idea of triadic harmony being so strong. He'd be thinking in terms of that C and a D. So there's lots of different relationships like that, you know, that you could have with different triads playing together at the same time. And a lot of times I would go through different relationships like that and try to put that together. So that way, I didn't want to be like the sitting duck. I didn't want to be the fall guy. You know, I wanted to be out there defying gravity with the horn players.
So it sounds like with Ornette, you were always on your toes.
Oh gosh, yeah.
You know, as a student, and then and a listener, and then as a player, there was never an opportunity to coast or just phone it in.
I always had to be at my very best. If I was eating lunch with him, I had to be at my very best. and it's amazing to have that kind of relationship in your life, because have something that, you know, when you go there, you've got to be firing on all cylinders or you'll just be left in the dust.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way he lived, just where every moment of every day was a potential creative decision. And let's have lunch. Well, where do you want to have lunch? Well, we could have it that place or this place. Well, how do you want to get there? Do you want to go now, or you don't want to wait a few minutes? Well, no, let's go this way. And you get there, well, you know, you don't have to order off the menu. And it would be every little instance of every mundane decision throughout the day, it would be as though he had never done it before, and that this was a creative decision to make, you know, and that rubbed off on the rest of us and forced us to think that way. And it would be a way of, it wasn't so much being challenged to drop your preconceptions and or to do something different just for the sake of doing something different. It was more like, it's a new day, we can do whatever we want. The slate's clean. What do you feel like doing right now? And it's like, don't assume that just because that seemed like the right decision yesterday that it's going to work today. And that's the way he was with music, too. I mean, we would play something, and we'd say, and he'd say, no, that's not the right note. And we'd say, well, yes, it is. We wrote it down. That's what you gave us yesterday. And he'd say, well, it's not the right note now. Mm. And so that's the way it was for lunch, for everything.
What was recording like with him? Because you recorded how many albums that you recorded?
Just the one. Just the one. And I, that was the only album that, at that time, that was recorded in his own studio.
The one on 125th?
Yeah, yeah. Because I think Virgin Beauty was in a commercial studio, I'm pretty sure.
Now, if I'm correct, see, Virgin Beauty, I think he'd had that album for a while and put the name Virgin Beauty on it. Or, yeah, I think that's... What were some of the tunes on Virgin Beauty? Do you have any recall of?
Three Wishes and Singing in the Shower and Happy Hour and Chanting and Honeymooners. And
is that the one that had Jerry Garcia on it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, that was a fresh album. That was new.
And from what I understand, the band didn't get to meet Jerry. Jerry came in and did his parts later. Byrne was telling me that because we actually opened for the band. I was in open for the Grateful Dead once, and Jerry came out and played Three Wishes with us. And Byrne Nix would say, you know, what was that like? Because we never got to meet him.
Wow. Now, was that the show in Oakland?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so you were part of that. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What? Do you know anything about how that relationship came about and how the band ended up opening? And then I think, didn't Ornette do some playing with the Grateful Dead as well at that show?
Yeah. He and DiNardo got up in the second half of, I guess, when they do their space jam, I think is
right.
You know, what they call it. And then I think they were just supposed to be playing for that, and DiNardo, you know, went off stage, but Ornette just stayed through the whole set, and so he was playing on, you know, Turn On Your Love Light and you know, the whole second set, and it was quite good.
Do you know how that came to be, and did Ornette ever talk about, you know, what was going on? Because it seemed like it was sort of a one-off thing.
See, this is tough. If this is for the history books. If I'm saying what I think I remember hearing once, it's a little suspect. I'm thinking that it was DiNardo that suggested they go to see the Grateful Dead one time. And I think I remember it was something like that he had said to Ornette, something like, why don't we check out the Grateful Dead? They also have two drummers. And that was the rationale, you know. Because that stuck in my head, that DiNardo or somebody had said that. Like, and so, for whatever reason, somehow it, you know, the relationship came from that, whatever that initial
that
point of contact was, yeah. And
wow.
Also, I know that when they would do, I guess, you know, have extended stays at the Madison Square Garden, which I think was probably impressive to Ornette. And it's funny, Ornette sort of, as you know, he lived around the corner from Madison Square Garden.
Right.
And I always got the feeling he always thought about that as sort of like being the neighborhood club, you know? You know what I mean? Who's doing well at the neighborhood club? You know, oh, the Grateful Dead are there for three or four nights in a row. Well, that's impressive.
Well, you know, he did have a keen interest in mass popular success. And
yeah.
When I knew him, this would have been 80, he was really thinking that was going to be, that was a possibility for him. I mean, he got, you know, that's why he got went with Bernstein, Sid Bernstein, because Bernstein had brought the Beatles or handled the New York side of the Beatles tour, and I think that was one of the motivations for getting involved with Sid Bernstein. And it's just, it's very interesting. It reminds me of a story that Charlie Ellerbe told me where when Ornette was still living in, on Remington Street, and Charlie had come up from Philly late at night and got there, and the doors were locked, and nobody was home, and he was like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And Ornette comes running down the street. He had just been at Madison Square Garden seeing Parliament, Funkadelic, or, you know, those guys. So, yeah, interesting. who would have ever bet, right, before that actually happened, before Ornette played with the Grateful Dead at the Oakland Coliseum, who would have ever bet that would have ever possibly happened, could have ever possibly happened? Just seemed like, you know, if somebody had asked me, I would say, well, it could happen, I guess, but it just seems like the least likely thing to happen, and yet it happened.
You know, I think people always assume that Ornette's interest in that kind of high-profile thing was, I don't know what you'd think, it was a social climbing somehow, or purely mercenary, or whatever, and I think I always got the feeling that he was well aware that if he and who he was and his station in life, meaning all the way from somebody who was a person of color to a jazz musician to that kind of jazz musician who had been so controversial and playing such non-mainstream material, that if he could crash that party,
mm-hmm.
that the world was a better place.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh,
I mean, it wasn't just good for his return this year. I mean, it was like that was good for all of us. That was good for society. If someone like him in all those ways could be part of that scene, could make that happen. Because, like you say, who would predict that could happen? That's not supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. And then once it does happen, well, I'm not going to say it's no big deal, but it's like going to the moon. You know, once it's happened, it's like, oh, yeah, sure, that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he did have, you know, in addition to the musical side of him, I mean, he did have a vision for, a better world. I mean, for lack of a more articulate way to say it, I mean, that was something. Improving conditions was something on his mind all the time, I thought.
Oh, for sure. I used to, when I would talk to students and stuff, the analogy I'd use was that it was like a human pyramid, and traditional music or traditional jazz combo situations, the soloist was the person at the apex, at the top of the human pyramid, and the bass player and the drummer were the grunts on the bottom. And then the chordal instruments, you know, maybe got to be in the middle there, which means they're still depending on the rhythm section, but they still have to support the soloist. So he was very much trying to, I think his expression was, trying to get rid of the caste system in music, he would say.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, and this for people who wonder what it was like hanging around with Ornette. These conversations about that were fairly common, you know, about topics like that. He'd have an idea and he'd want to, you know, share it and know what you think and let you know what he thought. And so,
and I was telling somebody else recently that, again, going back to what I was saying about thinking of myself primarily as a student of his, and part of that was because I didn't want to just, by virtue of being just some young, know-nothing, naive kid, inadvertently say the wrong thing, cause offense, be unknowingly insensitive about something, get myself in trouble, and have, you know, could have been any number of social faux pas I could have committed. And I thought, whenever he would try to change the subject, and I mean this to the end of his life, when he would try to change it to the music business or race relations or relations with the opposite sex or whatever, you know, some of his favorite topics were,
right.
I would, you know, go along a little bit, but I would gently steer it back to music, or as he would say, notes. He said to me one time, he said, "I'm a note man." He said, "Now, I'm not saying that's the only way to approach it." He says, "But that's the way I do it." He says, "I get there through notes."
Now, what did that mean to you when he said that?
Well, you know, a lot of times when you talk to musicians, and a lot of them can be very successful musicians, and what they want to talk about is, like, you know, gigs.
Okay.
Who's working? Yeah, who won the downbeat poll? What's on tap for tomorrow? You know, what kind of deal can I swing in this or that situation? Ornette was always ready, middle of the night, first thing in the morning, whatever it was, to talk about notes and really just the nuts and bolts of how you put a phrase together, how you put music together, just a laboratory of assembling notes. And that was where he could always go to ground and be centered and feel like he had some sort of control of what was going on. And also, that's really where I think he felt the content was in music. It wasn't in style. It was in phrase production.
Mm.
It was in actually, whether you're composing or improvising, it was, can you construct a better phrase, a stronger phrase, a catchier phrase, whatever it is, than the next guy? That's money in the bank. That's power.
Hmm.
You know, so I think that's really one thing I learned from him, because it seems like an obvious question, where is the content in music? But
yeah.
He really, by example, showed that it was being able to construct a phrase. And even at the time, At first, I wasn't sure I wanted to hear that, because I wanted to do something a little farther out, a little more abstract. And eventually I realized that even if you're working with non-pitched material, say, or, you know, are lots of different contexts, as abstract, as far out as you want to get, events still happen in sequence, and they still happen simultaneously. They still happen in chronological time. And really being able to master that was what he was after.
Wow. And, you know, and which leads to this, what an amazing composer he was. You know, people used to talk about him as a revolutionary and a, you know, this and that, and it's all true, but if nothing else, if you never got to hear him improvise or hear him play, and all you got were his tunes, I think his compositions were amazing.
Yeah.
His tune writing was amazing. And I was kind of surprised, for instance, even at the memorial, I think the only person that played primetime played at the end and played some, I'm not sure what tune they played, but the only guy that played an Ornette Coleman tune was, I think, Ravi Coltrane. And
they did Peace, right?
Yeah, and it was great to hear it, and it was great to hear it come from a, you know, someone that was not Ornette and not Ornette's band, because the tune just jumped out even more in a way.
And they did Lovano and David Murray did Only Woman, right?
Oh, okay, that's true. But I was glad to hear Robbie play, let's say, a more obscure tune, maybe, because I mean, a lot of people cover Lonely Woman, but not a lot of people club. I don't know whether he played The Invisible or, I forget the name of the tune, but it was one of the older ones from the early albums, and it's just such an amazingly beautifully crafted, you know, melody.
Like I said, I think that was Peace, right, was the name of the song.
Oh, you think? Okay. It might have been. But yeah, so that what you're talking about, his focus on the nuts and bolts and the, just the very basics of, okay, these are notes. How are we going to string them together? This is the art. He did that as in his composition as well. He did that as well as anybody ever did.
Yeah, and a real modular compositional style where he didn't really believe in strong notes and weak notes. He would tell us, you know, he didn't think there was any such thing as passing tones, you know, so it's, he didn't like chromatic ti-do, as they say in solfege, resolutions melodically. He was very much for a really almost architectural set of building blocks, where it was like he could take a phrase out of a composition and then still have it make sense, or switch the order of them, or take one phrase and modulate it, just put it in a different key. And the underlying structure, it wouldn't change the underlying structure, you know, because every building block was so strong. There weren't any weak links that he could just take something out and manipulate it that way. And so that's still something, you know, when I'm working with my own stuff, I always run the harmonic gauntlet with it, you know. Would Ornette have let that go? Is that strong enough? Or does that work? And sometimes I'll think, no, you know, I really need to go back and fix that. Occasionally I'll chuckle to myself and I'll think, he would have never gone for that. But I'm going to do it. And, you know, that's not always the right decision either. But still, just having that as an example to hold myself to is really important, because, you know, I just saw in real time, I mean, it really worked.
And that goes back into his fascination and appreciation of Buckminster Fuller and the geodesic dome structure and thinking like an architect.
Yeah, and like I said, I don't know that it was so much that he decided to apply Fuller's ideas to music. It was more that in Fuller's work he saw vindication for what he was observing in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, if people want to follow your work currently, what's the best way for them to do that?
I had a CD out, self-produced, I guess a couple of years ago, called The Garden of Equilibria. And so they might be able to find that. And then there was one that I did called The Eternal Hang on Accurate Records that came out in the 90s when I was with Ornette. There is an old album called Shock Exchange that has that trio with John Turner and Chris Bowman that I mentioned that came out in the mid-80s when I was studying with Ornette, and we do takes on Ramblin' and Broadway Blues on there, and Ornette did liner notes.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's vinyl only, and again, self-produced, and, you know, I don't have a copy of it, right? Well, yes, I do. I have a copy of it, but the only copy I have is one that was printed off-register, and I kept it kind of as a curiosity. I gave away the other ones I have. And I don't even know if we still have any more. One time when I was doing a gig in Chicago a few years ago, Jason Rebke, the bass player, came into the gig and came in with a copy of it and said he had just found it in a used record store.
Huh.
And so I said, how much did you pay for it? He said, $20. I said, $20? And we both agreed it must be for the liner notes. If you can find one, it's a collector's item for that reason. That beautiful liner notes, too.
God, I'd love to. You know, his writing style was really amazing. You really had to work to follow what he was saying, and sometimes it wasn't necessarily clear what he was saying because of the way he was using language, or at least it wasn't clear to me.
And if you read Fuller, there's a lot of similarities.
Oh, okay.
And again, I don't know if there's... if that was any direct influence from Fuller, if that was a happy accident, but there really is a lot of similarities in the way they use language.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, not having a copy of your own album, because when I met him, I think Don Cherry had given him, you know, those children's record players where they're like in a box and you can open them up, and, you know, now you have a little sound system. You know, it was like a carry thing, you know?
Yeah.
That was his record player, you know, that was it. You know, he didn't have a sound system or anything like that. And he didn't have any of his own records. And I remember we went out one day and got a copy from a record store of Skies of America. because he wanted to listen to it. Or he wanted me to listen to it, and he didn't have a copy. So, yeah, it's just a funny, something that you wouldn't expect. Do you have a website by any chance?
Yes. I think it's, I never go there, so I don't know what it is. I think it's dbryantmusic.com.
Okay. Let me go to my computer and take a look, see if that's in there. Anything else, anything maybe that we left out that you think would be important to share with people who never had the opportunity of meeting and hanging out a bit and talking with Ornette Coleman the person versus Ornette Coleman the media? You know, most people just know him through media, through a CD or through even a video.
Just that he was not, for me anyway, a disappointment on any level. I mean, it was just as extraordinary being in his presence as you might think it must have been.
Wow.
And it was like that all the time. You know, one time, but at the same time, as inspiring and creative and invigorating as it was to be around him, such a pleasant person, usually such a kind, generous, polite person. Mm-hmm. One time we were in, I think it was in Germany, and I was down in the hotel lobby waiting for everybody to get together so we could get on the shuttle bus to the venue from the hotel. And I was talking to the driver that worked for the festival, and he said, "All you guys that work with Ornette," he says, "you're all such nice guys." He says, "You're so professional. You show up on time." He says, "It's just, you know, it's, why is that?" You know, he says, I can't get over it. And I said, "Well, I think that kind of thing starts at the top." I said, "Ornette is just such a gracious, kind, professional person, you know, 99% of the time that none of us would do anything, you know, to cross him, embarrass him, you know, not follow his lead." I said, "We're just, you know, following the example he sets," I think, is kind of the way it works. And the guy stops and shakes his head and thinks for a minute, and he says, "Yeah," he says, "yeah, I think you're exactly right." He says, "You know, just last week, Miles Davis's band came through here, and everybody was an asshole."
Well, I never met Miles, and you know, but I was kind of scared of him, frankly. But
no,
yeah,
well, I hear from Bottle Roy that he was quite a wonderful person too. So, but that's a great story.
that is funny. But yeah, I love what you said, that he was everything you expected from. Yeah, because you know, you meet great people, and you know, you find out, well, they got some flaws. Everybody's got some flaw, but Ornette really, and that's one of the reasons I wanted, why I'm doing this, is he really was an extraordinary person.
Yeah.
As you pointed out, and yeah, I'm glad you also mentioned the what great manners, and I feel I learned my manners from him, honestly, because I was 20, I was completely uncivilized when I met him. And what I saw too was, maybe you saw this too, his listening, obviously to music, but also to human beings.
Yeah.
I never saw anybody listen so well or so thoroughly as, I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, he never took it for granted that someone wanted to spend time with him. I mean, he always seemed to appreciate that, which somebody that high profile as he had, you would expect him to, you know, be a little numb to the attentions of others, but not at all. If somebody took him seriously and really enjoyed his company and really wanted to interact with him, he really seemed to appreciate it.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks so much for this. And in fact, your website is dbryantmusic.com. I'll encourage everybody to go to today's website and check out the things that he does. And thank you for this time and putting some of this on the record so that people who heard Ornette's music and loved it and were fascinated by it can have some picture of the human being behind it. And I think it's just important, especially in his case. Well, Dave, thank you very much.
Sure. And as we say, if anybody wants to get in touch with me, I am in the book.
but in the Boston book.
That's right. I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yeah.
Okay. Cambridge, Mass. Dave Bryant, B-Y-B-R-Y-A-N-T.
That's right. Not to be confused with the other David Bryant, who's a wonderful pianist in New York now. He was at the New England Conservatory here in Boston for a while. And I think we have unspoken gentleman's agreement that he goes by David now and I go by Dave. But, you know, just we were on the same bill one time and he played before I did, and I told him that I felt so much better because now no matter what I did, everybody would say Dave Bryant sounded great last night.
All right. Well, again, thanks again, and maybe we'll maybe meet in person sometime. Are you calling in from Cambridge?
Yes.
Oh, okay, cool. Just in case you're curious, you're calling Tivoli, New York.
Very good.
Yeah, I live just a few blocks from, well, blocks, country blocks from Sonny Rollins, but he's moved over to Woodstock now. But that's sort of where we live, in that part of the world, up Hudson Valley.
Oh, very good. I actually have you don't have to include this on your website. This is not Ornette material here. But there's something from working with Ornette that I always wanted to ask Sonny Rollins. And I actually sent a note on Facebook to Brett Primack, you know, that does so much stuff with Sonny Rollins. And I explained the whole thing in a message to him, and he never got back to me. I thought it was a great request. I was just like, if you happen to be around him, if this happens to come up, you know, would you ask him? And you know how people are always speculating as to why Sonny started performing with Bob Cranshaw playing electric bass all the time instead of upright, and a lot of controversy about that, a lot of people didn't like the electric bass and so forth. And commercial reasons, and I've heard all kinds of theories and conspiracies, and you know why that worked out that way. And something that I actually talked to Ornette about was Ornette's thing of not having any weak notes, weak phrases. And you know, part of that in-out bellows breath of conventional harmony involves like voice leading, like when you play a chord progression on the piano. And he never wanted me to play a traditionally voice-led chromatic chord progression. He always wanted me to, you know, pick up my hands and move them and put them down and just have triads or chords and sounds that moved around, didn't have that strong to weak, weak to strong, back and forth progression. And so one of those things that works that way is a lot of times in the traditional voice leading, one of those weak chords will be a diminished chord.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that I learned from playing some stuff with Ornette with electric bass players was when you're playing diminished sound, and that's one thing I did when we were talking about what I did harmonically, a lot of times I would try to find a diminished or an augmented chord that was not, didn't have the same tonic as the key we were in, and sort of approach our tonality obliquely from the outside, you know, diminished or augmented. And so with the electric bass, one of the things about it that I think for some people is would be a criticism is it doesn't breathe the way the upright does. And when you play a chord progression, or if you play a diminished chord, it doesn't give you that kind of weak kind of sound. It's sort of like the great equalizer. Everything has, the diminished chord has got the same weight as the major and minor tonalities.
On electric bass.
Yeah. So, you know, Sonny Rollins, a lot of the tunes that he calls are those kind of Irving Berlin tunes, and unusual tunes. And one thing that they have in common is he has calls a lot of tunes that have diminished chords in them. And so it occurred to me one time, just thinking about it when I was working on this with Ornette, that I bet the reason, because this is, you know, around the same time he started using electric bass all the time, is when he went to that really big, hard tenor sound, you know, with, I'm not sure what the difference is with the reeds and the mouthpieces and all that go into that, but still, you know, where it's like he's got the electric bass and that big, hard tenor sound kind of, you know, butting heads. And it occurred to me that he wants to be able to play those diminished chords, approach them from a position of strength, the way Ornette does.
Okay.
And so I can't remember exactly how I phrased it. I put it a lot better and more succinctly when I wrote Mr. Premack. But anyway, I always wanted to ask Sonny Rollins, is that one reason you wanted to use the electric bass more often? Because I saw in an interview one time with him, he said something like, that's one very important piece of advice to give to young people was how to play off of diminished chords. That's something you had to come to terms with, was how to deal with diminished tonalities.
Huh.
And so I thought, there's something to that, and there's an Ornette link there. So,
interesting. Okay.
If he ever visits the old neighborhood, Ken, I want you to...
I'll break out this recording and play him your question. Maybe we'll get the answer. It could happen. Well, cool. Well, thanks again, Dave. Appreciate it. And
no,
yeah,
great talking with you. Maybe I'll run into you with Chris sometime. I actually went and did a trio session with Chris and John Manigan, bass player, at Chris's studio at his house last year. And was it last year or was it? It may have been 2017 by the time we did it. I can't remember exactly what month it was. But anyway, he recorded it and videoed it, and he's sitting on all of it. I think they're mixing it or editing it or doing something with it. I'm not sure exactly what it is he wants to do with it.
He showed me a little bit of the video, and I'll tell you what, when he's ready to promote it, we'll mail it out. You know, I don't think I told you this, but you know, we have 40,000 plus active subscribers to Jazz on the Tube, so we get the word out, you know. So that was some good stuff. I watched about 20 minutes of it, and I really liked it.
Oh, very cool thing.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. All right. Well, again, thanks a lot, and see you around the Hudson Valley maybe someday.
Oh, that would be great. Thank you so much, and I'll I send you a note with email addresses of some of the other guys, and one that gets left out a lot, I know, is James Kamal Jones, who went by the name Sabir Kamal when he was with Ornette and plays drums on the opening the Caravan of Dreams album.
Okay.
And so that's him in the Shirley Clark, you know, Made in America movie, that he's the other drummer in the band on that. And he lives in Boston now.
Okay.
And so we had been out of touch, and so see him, but I can give you emails for him and Chris and Kenny and Bottle Roy, and I don't think you'd talk to Byrne yet.
No, I haven't talked to Byrne, no.
But I'm in touch with Byrne and play with him sometimes. So.
Okay, I have to be on my toes when I interview Byrne.
Oh, he's the easiest guy to talk to in the world.
No, I know, but he's got a really incisive intellect, I guess. I mean, for lack of a better word, you know what I mean?
He's one of those guys. He can hold forth on any topic. But again, he's, you know, just a very kind person and very easy to talk to.
Okay, good. All right, cool. Well, again, thanks so much, and to everybody in Jazz on the Tube, you got some great insight. I'm telling you, you're not going to find many other places, and it's great that we have these recollections from people that worked directly with Ornette, because he was not just another musician. he was a force of nature and a really interesting human being.
Well, I think the Rashomon version is the one to go for. So, yeah, I, as many folks as you could talk to is definitely the way to go to approach the subject.
Cool. Thanks again.
All right, man. See you soon. Bye-bye.